Hello and welcome to episode 9 of The Phantom Marine. This is Chris DeRose. Hello to everyone who found us through the Tulsa World article by Tim Stanley. In January and February of 1946, the story of the Phantom Marine dominated newspaper covers across the United States. But in the 76 years that followed, almost nothing has been written about William Langston and this incredible story. That changed recently with a piece in the Tulsa World following our investigation in this podcast. If you haven't had a chance to read it, I've provided a link at our webpage at chrisderosebooks.com/phantom and on our Facebook page, facebook.com/phantommarine. In today's episode, we will continue exploring the concept of imposters. In our last episode, we focused on the story of Martin Guerre, a man who left his family and who was replaced by an imposter for 4 years. Today we will be looking at the inverse situation, of a man who abandoned his previous life, but later sought to return and claim his identity, and what he had to go through in order to prove it. Joining me to discuss this incredible case is Dr. Jeffrey Revelle of the History Department at MIT. He is the author of The Would-Be Commoner, A Tale of Deception, Murder, and Justice in 17th Century France. I'll let Jeff take it from here.
Louis Lapivardière was a very minor member of the provincial nobility towards the end of the 17th century, and he lived what for a nobleman was a pretty penurious existence, did not inherit a lot from his father, married a woman who was not a member of the local nobility but was well off, high bourgeoisie, named Marguerite Chauvelin, and it was not particularly... the sparks weren't flying in the marriage, and he then decided to pursue a military career, which is another way to both prestige and wealth if you manage it correctly. But he wasn't very good at that either. He was doing that during the time of the war, the 9 Years' War, 1689 to 1698. And eventually he kind of gave up on that as well, but didn't really tell his wife back in the Berry, in the center of France, and kind of wandered off and ended up getting involved with an innkeeper's daughter in the Burgundian town of Auxerre, and eventually married her. And there's a marriage contract that he signed, and he sort of changed his name a little bit. He called himself Louis Dubochet instead of Louis Lapivardière. And eventually the word got back to the first wife back in Berry, and he from time to time would wander back to the home he shared with the first wife. And one time when he showed up, she said, you know, look, I've heard about this, what gives? And they had a big fight, and in the middle of the night he seems to have disappeared from their house. And within a week or two, rumors were circulating that Marguerite Chauvelin, the first wife, had murdered him, or had him murdered. And perhaps one of her accomplices was a local priest whom she allegedly was having an affair with. None of it is clear that that was going on at all. So then some local police inspectors started looking into the case and decided to pursue it, and what we would call filed charges against her today, tried to imprison her. She disappeared. Her two maidservants became major witnesses in the case, and they testified that they had actually watched her murdering him, and it helped. It's unclear if that really happened or if the police officers who detained them forced them to say this for their own reasons. And anyway, Louis Lapivardière disappeared. And they couldn't find him, and there was no body, and nobody knew what was going on with this case. So eventually, it went through the courts in the local area and in the center of France, in the Berry, and the case ended up being kicked up to the appeals court in Paris. And at that point, word got out that the guy was still alive, supposedly, and he was with the second wife in Burgundy. And he was sent a safe conduct pass to travel from Burgundy up to Paris to appear in the case. And he showed up, and for about a year, there was a court procedure that went on in Paris where they attempted to determine if this person who allegedly was Louis Lapidotière and would exonerate the first wife from having murdered him if he was still alive, really was who he said he was. And to my mind, that's when the case gets really interesting because of the various techniques that were available at the end of the 17th century to try to prove identity. I mean, it was a period before fingerprints and before there were state fashion forms of identity, but nothing as reliable as we assume those documents are today. And so the court went through a series of procedures to try to identify whether or not, to try to determine whether or not this really was the man who was supposedly murdered. Those included handwriting samples, interviews with people who had known him both before he was allegedly murdered and then afterwards, and then a very lengthy interrogation of the man himself to see if he really knew all the right details of the story and could prove to be who he was. And so they went through this process, and at the end of the day, there was a very learned magistrate who becomes an important political figure in the first half of the 18th century in France, a man named Henri-François d'Aguesseau. And d'Aguesseau examines all the evidence and makes this very interesting statement to the court that, as far as we can tell, yes, we think this is Louis Lapivartière, but we have to be humble in the face of what we don't know and what only God ultimately understands. And so part of the interest of the story for me is this sense that there is a kind of Cartesian logic to the steps of identifying whether or not Louis Lapivartière is who he really says he is. But there is also a sort of profoundly Jansenist, which is a sort of Catholic sect that was popular in France at the time, a kind of Jansenist sense of humility and the ultimate limitations of human knowledge, and that tension between what humans can and can't know and what epistemological tools are available to them to know things is also a very interesting part of the story to me.
Can you discuss the evidence on both? What did people come away with, the people who'd known him before his alleged death? What did they, were they divided? Was there a consensus? Did he have the right answers to their questions?
That the majority of people, and there was an interesting variety of people who had known him. There were other sort of provincial noblemen in lesser or greater circumstances, and then there were sort of farmhands and other people who had interactions with him, sometimes in neighboring villages where there were marketplaces. And the ones who were in Paris, for the most part, were able to, they told the investigators that they thought this really was the true Louis Lapivartière because he was able to recollect certain events that they had shared or remember the details of land transactions or that sort of thing. The handwriting part I thought was very interesting because what they had were documents that Louis Lapivartière had signed before he was allegedly murdered by the first wife, and then documents which the person who claimed to be Louis Lapivartière afterwards had signed, had also signed. And so they had these handwriting experts, and this was a pretty common sort of legal technique in the late 17th and 18th century, come in and compare the handwriting. And they came to the conclusion that for the most part, it seemed as though the document signed after the death used the same hand as the document signed before the death. They cited some discrepancies in spelling, but at the end of the day, that's not a big concern because spelling was far less standardized in written European languages, not just French, but most of them at the end of the 17th century. I mean, I don't know if you'd like me to talk at all about the interrogation, which took place in 8 sessions over 6 days of the man who claimed to be Louis Lapivartière, which is really, I found to be the most amazing document in the whole story. It's very lengthy. It's, I think, like 60 or 70 pages of this procedure that was codified by French law for how you interrogate people in a criminal manner. And it consists of a series of questions. And the interrogator asks questions, jumps around to different parts of the life story. There's no consistency because he's constantly trying to trip up the person who is trying, in this case, to allege that he's Louis La Pivartière. And what was really interesting was the number of times that the interrogator says, all right, well, if you really were the real Louis La Pivartière, you would have done this and that. And the guy always interrupts him and says, but I am the real Louis La Pivartière, and you don't know what you're talking about, and the people who are telling you otherwise don't know what they're talking about. He was very on point throughout the entire interrogations. And if he really wasn't Louis La Pivartière, it was a bravura performance, because the transcript seems to indicate that he really pulled it off. In that sense, the case is a little bit different than Martin Guerre, because the false Martin Guerre showed up after about a 12-year absence. And, you know, he'd been off at war, he came back, he was older, the person who showed up was older, a little bit stockier, but people just thought that was kind of a natural progression. With Louis La Pivartière, so if I'm remembering the chronology correctly, it's about 1693 or 1694 that he stops being home regularly in the Berry with his first wife. And he comes back periodically. And the last time, of course, is in 1697 when he is allegedly murdered and he just disappears. When he came back that last time, when he was allegedly murdered, nobody had any question whether or not it was him. But in the immediate aftermath in the local vicinity, as people started to speculate that maybe she had had him murdered and they cut up the body and buried it or something like that, I think the desire to fuel that narrative made people predisposed to think back to what they had seen and wonder if that was really the person who was supposed to be Louis La Pivartière. And for the next year or so, as the case makes its way to Paris and then is being investigated, there is a lot of contradiction and confusion about what his physical appearance looked like and how one should identify him. And there's also an interesting point, I talk about this in the book. So when the case gets to Paris, there are legal briefs that are published, because that was a common practice, especially in sensational criminal trials. And the legal briefs for this trial have engravings, frontispieces, designed that purport to represent both Louis La Pivartière and his first wife, Marguerite Chauvelin. The Marguerite Chauvelin one, perhaps that's accurate. The Louis La Pivartière frontispiece is entirely stylized. It makes him appear much wealthier than he was, much younger than he was, much more dashing than he was. What we know about the actual circumstances of his life at that point make that it entirely impossible that that image was what he actually looked like. But it kind of took on his appearance in the popular imagination because of its circulation in the press. And this is another interesting part of the story. I didn't talk much about the sort of media ecology of Paris when this case arrives there in 1698. But there are all sorts of ways that information circulates, both via print and also the theater is an important part of that sort of media ecology in late 17th century Paris. And another interesting thing, in fact, the way that I got started working on this project is that the leading theater company in Paris at the time the case was being tried, which is the Comédie Française, and which still exists and performs in Paris today, commissioned a play about the case. It didn't use the exact names, it sort of changed some circumstances, but people, contemporaries, recognized that, oh, this is a riff on the Pivartière case. And so while his case was being tried, while these briefs were circulating, his image was in the public, you could also go to the theater and see the case being staged and see how people were responding to it every night. So all of this is very far from the local specificities of the Berry, where he lived with the first wife, and transforms the case into something quite different and interesting within the context of late 17th century Paris.
So if he's recognized by people who see him, and quite a few people come to see him, and he withstands this interrogation, why the protracted legal proceedings? It seems to go on for, what, another 8 months after his return?
Right. Well, the first Paris trial, he still isn't there. And they only discover that somebody who supposedly is him is in hiding in Burgundy about halfway through that trial. The first part of the trial is still the murder trial against the first wife. And then they realize, oh, maybe he's still alive. And so he gets brought back to Paris, and then the court issues a sort of stay in the murder trial and says, no, now we have to conduct this investigation into his identity using all the tools that are available according to the criminal code at the end of the 17th century. And so that second 8 months that you're talking about when he shows back, it's not the murder trial, it's an investigation into whether or not he is still alive, which obviously, if they determine he is still alive, brings a halt to the murder case, and that's what they were trying to figure out.
Yeah, and I know, Louis drifts out of the historical record shortly after this case, but I know my listeners will want to know what happens with that second marriage. You know, it's an incredible trial that this marriage goes through with him having to own up to his bigamy, and, you know, returning to Paris and being, you know, in such a public way due to their marriage.
Well, what happens is that the family of the first wife, Marguerite Chauvelin, I mean, she doesn't live a very luxurious life in the center of Paris, but she has family relatives in Paris who actually are, they become high-up government officials and enjoy a certain amount of status and wealth in Paris. And so when all of this is going on, she comes up to Paris, and it's clear that she relies on her family to help get her out of this mess, being accused of murdering her first husband. And one of the things that I think the family with its connections is able to do is to reach out to the second wife, who's a young girl at that point, probably, you know, early 20s. And there is a record of the young girl and her mother from Burgundy coming up to Paris, and it does appear that the first wife and her family paid them off to just basically go away and not make any more claims and just leave the whole acquaintance. And so there isn't any record of a formal annulment of that marriage. It just seems that the second wife and her mother and her family were paid off, and they went away and agreed not to pursue any claims they might have had.
So Louis maybe never even sees her again after coming to Paris under the safe conduct letter?
Yeah, that's entirely possible. I mean, you know, in my sort of fantasy movie script, what I imagine happening is that he kind of, you know, at one point we know that he went to one of the Atlantic seaports of France and was possibly exploring getting into the Navy. And, you know, my sort of fantasy continuation of his story is that he gets involved in privateering and gets involved in piracy circles in the Caribbean and who knows what else. I mean, that seems like the kind of adventure he would throw himself into. But, you know, we don't know. In the last trace I found of him in any historical document is in the summer of 1699, back in the Berry for one last time with the first wife, and then there's nothing more.
Thank you again to Dr. Revelle for joining us. If you are interested in the full story behind Louis's dramatic reappearance in Paris, check out Dr. Revelle's book, The Would-Be Commoner. So what does all of this mean for our case? Despite a lengthy and detailed investigation into Louis's reappearance in Paris during the murder trial of his ex-wife, the fact of the matter is that people who knew Louis didn't really seem to be in doubt that it was him. He answered the right questions the right way, and he passed the test. And indeed he should have. It was really him. Likewise, the man with the limp succeeded in convincing almost everyone he encountered in Newport, Arkansas, that he was William Langston. We don't have a 60-page transcript of what he was asked and how he answered as we do with Louis, but we do have a few concrete examples. The first, and to my mind the most convincing, is his exchange with Lacey Fields. Fields said, "If you're William Langston, tell me whether I was ever at your house." The man with the limp responded that the answer was yes, that it was when he was living with his mother, and that he had come with Dutch Vaughn. And when he arrived, Dove Duncan and Mo Jordan were already present. That is such a specific recollection. It is such an old event that he's describing, and it is just not the sort of thing you would talk about with someone in a foxhole. It's just a totally ordinary visit to your house with some people from the neighborhood when you were young. That I don't know how anyone besides William Langston could have possibly known that. According to Fields' wife, the man with the limp described to her a specific event, we don't know what exactly, that happened at a pool hall that had been owned by the Fields, and his description was sufficient to convince her that he was in fact William Langston. We have a few concrete examples of the man with the limp recognizing people and calling them by their nicknames, sometimes old nicknames, and referencing their family members by nicknames. So while we don't have a long list of things that the man with the limp was asked and how he answered, we know that whatever it was he said was sufficient to convince people who had known William Langston his entire life, people he'd grown up with, his former neighbors, his classmates, his teammates. And we know that the man with the limp wasn't shying away from these kinds of potentially revealing exchanges. His visit occurred at a leisurely pace. He went into cafes and into bars and billiard halls. He went into stores. He visited people at their homes. He stayed the night at George Crownover's house. It hardly seems like the kind of thing that you would do if you felt you were at risk of exposure. So Louis is able to convince all of Paris that he's the genuine article because he really was who he said he was. And the man with the limp was similarly able to convince nearly everyone in Newport, Arkansas. Arnaud de T, the imposter who impersonated Martin Guerre, was met with a lot of skepticism when he arrived in town. However, he was embraced by Martin Guerre's wife, not because she was fooled by whether this man was her husband, but because abandoned women were left in limbo at this particular point in place and time. She couldn't socialize with married women, nor could she find a new husband for herself. So of course, after 8 or 9 years, she's going to accept this man as her husband. That part isn't surprising. And she supplied him with the memories he needed to convince the rest of the community. It's even possible that Arnaud de T impersonated Martin Guerre at the request of Martin Guerre's sisters. But in our case, there is no obvious explanation for how the man with the limp had the memories, specific detailed memories of William Langston. Perhaps as in Louis's case, he managed to convince everyone because he was who he said he was. In our next episode, we will begin wrapping up the mystery of the Phantom Marine, find out what happens when his body is exhumed on Iwo Jima, and learn where the mystery stands today. As the man with the limp once wrote, "I'm yours for the truth, Chris DeRose."